As the city of Jacksonville pledges new money to fight gun violence, local activists say much more needs to be done to end the bloodshed. That conversation just ahead this morning. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, after a bloody and horrible and deadly weekend in Jacksonville, community activists are demanding changes to get to the root of gun violence in this city. And it is far from the first time we've been here in this place. Already getting calls? Give us a call at 549-2937. Then later, a look at the temporary nature of the American workforce, a conversation with author Lewis Hyman about his new book, Temp. All of that and more ahead this hour, but first this morning, the deadly gun violence in this city has reached a boiling point yet again. A Friday night shooting last week at a Raines Lee High School football game left one person dead and a 16-year-old charged with murder. That was followed on Sunday by a shooting at the Jacksonville Landing, technically a mass shooting, that killed three people, including the gunman, and 11 more injured. These events have once again put Jacksonville in an unwelcome international spotlight. Demands are louder than ever, urging that more needs to be done to curb the violence and death. It's a familiar narrative in this city that has played for many years, and it will take more than candlelight vigils, thoughts, and prayers to make progress against the violence that plagues the First Coast and the city. What can be done? Well, yesterday, city council members met with community activists and faith-based leaders looking for solutions. That was followed by last night's city council meeting, where many activists walked out in protest. They said Council President Aaron Bowman wouldn't allow a public discussion around this issue. We're going to discuss it in depth right now as we welcome Ben Frazier from the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville. Good morning to you, Ben.
Good morning, everybody.
Wells Todd from the Jacksonville Progressive Coalition.
Good morning, Melissa.
And the Reverend Atlas Rankin, pastor of New Life Community Church. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Lots of calls already. What are your thoughts about this? Another deadly weekend in this city. What's being done? What should be done? 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or let us know your thoughts on Facebook. Ben Frazier, let's begin with you. You presented a 10-point plan for recovery to the city council this week. And then last night, there was a bit of a walkout. Angry advocates coming to meet with city officials. Things went south. And
let's call it like it is. It wasn't just a bit of a walkout. We weren't kicked out of City Hall last night. We decided to walk out in protest. We led 100 people out. We were concerned that the council president doesn't really want the people to know what's going on. So, quite frankly speaking, I decided to ask them out loud and stridently and in an impassioned way, what about the voice of the people? We intentionally disrupted the city council meeting, and we will do so again. We led 100 people out. We will not allow this government to conduct business in the booth, in the back, in the dark, in the corner. This was a de facto violation of government in the sunshine.
Easily. You're saying that they didn't let you have time allotted to speak? I wasn't there, so tell me what happened.
Essentially, there was a vote challenging the council president, who says, tell you what, if you guys want to have something to say to a city council person, go over there on the side, and you all can talk. A very patronizing attitude. But the law clearly states, government in the sunshine, that that's not the way it works. What it says is that these kind of things should take place in the open, not over in the corner. So that while it did not violate the statutory provisions of the letter of the law, clearly pushing it off the public floor, out of the public's eye and ear, is a violation of the spirit
Okay.
Of the law.
Now, as that issue plays out, let's talk, too, about the reason for the anger and frustration, which is, once again, Jacksonville is dealing with an incredibly stubborn and tragic and long-lasting gun violence and homicide issue. Pastor Rankin, your organization lost city funding a few years ago in your efforts to work on this problem. You're going to keep working on it. At the same time, now we're hearing the city say they'd like to commit new funds to this. They're a fraction of the funds, we need to point out, that were committed back during the Peyton mayoral administration for the Jacksonville Journey. That was a $35 million initiative that was intended to get at the heart of this problem in Jacksonville. You know, a whole wide range of prevention and intervention programs specifically focused on kids, on families, on helping challenged neighborhoods. And then that funding just blew away in the wind. So what do you think now about the city coming back and saying, well, we want to commit anywhere from $50,000 to $300,000 to this, when at one point the city was spending $35 million on this?
Well, to be honest, anything helps, number one. And so we're not saying we're not grateful for what they're committing to our young people. But to me, you have to look at your investment. The quote of scripture, it says that the your wherever your treasures are,
come
there will
now.
Your heart be also.
That's right.
And you can't say that you really want to stop the problem of the violence and the crime with our young people if you're always putting yourself in a reaction mode. And we should, instead of always reacting to the problem, we should be able to prevent the problem from happening in the first place.
And we know there's data, and this has been exhaustively studied. We know what will work. The issue is political will, committing the resources to the solutions to this.
Well, it's about putting the money in the right hands, first of all. There are a lot of churches that are in the neighborhood that we're in, and we're getting zero funding. And it's almost like we're always behind what's going on in other sides of town. And as we look at it, the monies that are coming for stopping this stuff is actually outside of our neighborhoods and not where the problem is. Our church is surrounded by trap houses, drug houses, prostitution houses, and all kinds of things. And
that's
our
right.
Kids are walking past this every day.
And you knew a little bit about the young people that were involved in the incident at Raines High School.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate incident. I coached actually Robert Howard. I coached him at Forest View. He has a great family, great support system, but somewhere down the line, he disconnected from it and got involved with these other gangs. The guy who got killed at Raines, he's a cousin to our family. And this is a constant problem where the parents are helping and they're doing the right thing, but you can't watch your kids all day long. They're going to do what they want to do. But what's happening is there are too many negative influences that are attracting our kids. And the government could help support the positive environments and by investing more money that we can say, hey, we got some good things going over here, too.
And Wells Todd, let's talk about that. The city is going to work through this new agency, the Kids Hope Alliance, on this issue. What are your thoughts about that and how effective that new agency can be in terms of getting at the roots of this?
Well, I want to go back to what you said just a few minutes ago, Melissa, when you talked about how much money had been spent in the past. What we are going through and what we have gone through in the past 20 years or so in Jacksonville and across this country has been a siphoning off of money from programs that are needed, absolutely needed in our communities. The money that they want to offer us now is a drop in the bucket.
Thank
compared
you.
To the millions and millions of dollars that they have stolen from this city and from this nation.
That's right.
I want to say that.
Stolen how?
They have created an atmosphere in this country, and I need to quote Dr. King. In his speech in 1967, he gave in New York City at a church there, He said, the war has played havoc with our domestic destinies. He went on to say that it has put us in a position of appearing to the world as an arrogant nation. We are spending trillions of dollars, siphoning off trillions of dollars of our tax dollars that have been going into a war that started in 2003.
Afghanistan, the longest war in our nation's history.
Okay. And they are bombing seven countries or more. What we're saying here is what happened back in the 60s. President Johnson tried to do a New Deal program, and he's trying to fund a war at the same time. You can't do that. You can't do that. You have to put the money in the community where it belongs. We have to understand that when you siphon off this money, when you steal from the community, when you put people in poverty.
Let me ask you, Wells, I'm not disagreeing with you, but the people that run this city don't have control over the federal purse strings. So let me ask you just about how the city dollars are managed.
Then let's talk about that, because I think, in effect, what this establishment is doing, the power grid that we're looking at in Jacksonville, is playing with our intelligence. Now, folks, let's talk about money. You want to throw $500,000 at us like that's a big deal? We're humble, folks, but that is a mere pittance. It is a drop in the bucket. The mayor's budget is $1.2 billion. And until you start to focus on putting real money and giving us our piece of the economic pie, exactly, then all you're doing is playing games.
All right.
We want the money. We want our piece.
And let me go to lots of calls on this. Catherine is on the north side. Hi, Catherine. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and to your panelists. First of all, I would like to make a comment that to the ministers that are there. I think it's time for ministers to stop reaching out to the local agencies for the money that's needed to help the ills of the community. I think black churches need to do more for their own community instead of waiting for support from other organizations. I don't think you do enough. That's my main concern. But addressing the shooting at Raines High School, there were over 50 police officers at that event. And 50 police officers did not do the job that they were there to do. And why is that? Because my belief is that the center, the police enforce, the law enforcement center that they're trying to get support for, this is all part of the narrative that helps enforce that, get the money to fund that center, because they're making the northwest, the north side of town, and where there's a predominance of like a police state, we have cameras that have gone up after the mayor said that the sheriff said there would be no more enforcement of the stoplight cameras, but there are cameras going up in these areas that suggest that possibly we have the visualization of who I can't think of it right now.
Yeah, but and I get your point, Catherine.
I have also one other point. Okay. The tower that's going up at 4622, an intercept tower, that's being requested. Now, it's part of a bigger picture to get the funding and make this a police state. That's my view.
All right.
Thank you.
And thank you for that. Pastor Rankin, by the way, just to clarify, the Kids Hope Alliance is funded to the tune of, I think about, I'm being told, about $40 million. The $350,000 or so that would go to faith-based groups like yours, if you applied and were accepted, you'd get some of that. Right. I know that some organizations feel like only bigger organizations are getting Correct. That money. So what about Catherine's comments?
Well, I want to say this first of all. There's a big misnomer about the churches. First of all, the churches don't get that much money. We average, to be honest with you, we average $100 an offering a Sunday with 45 people attending. The bigger churches that's bringing in the more money, most money, that's a different, the average church, I deal with about 45 different churches, and none of us are bringing in that big money like that. Most of us as pastors, we're spending money out of our own pockets to keep the lights on at the church. And so to say that we're not doing as much as we should, we're doing the most with what we have. Now, and that's record. We want to do more, and our ministry industry with no funding and very little funding. We have served over 50, between 65 to 100 kids every summer for the last 14 years. And so to say, oh, we need to do more. Actually, it's the smaller churches that don't have funding that are doing the most. And so I want to put that out there, because we say all of this stuff and we down talk mm-hmm. pastors and we down talk the church. And when crises happen, that's who we depend on to come and rescue.
And so all of you are saying you'd like the activists on the ground, like the pastor and others, to get more play from the city funding going towards this problem. Yes. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say, but let's get back on point. What we're also saying is that law enforcement, JSO more precisely, is in denial. It continues to use the same police tactics, the same strategies, and we already see that they're not working. It's time for new and innovative ideas.
Right.
Folks, there is ample room for improvement. Otherwise, we wouldn't be sitting around this table right here. It's time for JSO to do something new. JSO is in denial. You got a 70% unsolved homicide rate. Where are all these guns coming from? Why aren't we asking the sheriff? Doesn't he know? Then if he knows, why isn't he stopping it? There is something wrong here, guys.
What should JSO be doing differently, in your opinion?
What should JSO be doing differently?
Yeah.
I think it needs to end its policies, tactics, and strategies that may involve racial bias. I think it needs to attempt to increase its level of trust between the black community and the police. I think that they need to be more transparent. We never heard about what happened with Walking While Black. We never heard about these cameras. What about the damn cameras? Are they going to put them out or what? When? How many? So we got issues with regard to trust, transparency, and accountability at JSO. These things will help us deal with gun violence in our city.
And as we continue to talk about this, let me also make sure that we get a few more callers on the air. Monique is in Bay Meadows. Go ahead, Monique.
Hello. Hi. I'm calling to actually find out just in general, just about the leaders in the city council's response yesterday. They seem to be more willing to be lapdogs for the mayor rather than stand with the people and build more infrastructure and actually fund grassroots programs that are addressing systematic violence. And I just want to know the community's response to that and how we can rally together to call for police accountability and call for accountability from the council who's supposed to serve the people.
Okay, thanks for that. Mayor Curry ran on a public safety platform. He's running for re-election. He's faced some criticism over how he's responded to this. Wells Todd, your thoughts about the mayor, the relationship with the council, and how they should be responding to this.
I think we have a mayor who is in sitting in City Hall, who is a supporter of Donald Trump. I think the budget that he's put forward, we need to trash it. They want to give $30 million to the police department.
Rejected.
Where that money should be going into the community.
Yes.
We will return to City Hall again, and we will demand to have an open and frank discussion. Right today, as a matter of fact, the mayor is going to do a photo op at Ken Knight Drive, where people suffered dramatically from the hurricane last year. And he did nothing to truly help those people at Ken Knight Drive. So what we're saying and
you're
what
saying,
I'm saying
You're
here,
saying City Hall didn't help that community.
I'm saying that the mayor Curry,
in terms of money going into that community after Irma.
After Irma, after the devastating effects of that hurricane, people's homes were flooded.
Okay? I realize that, but let's keep it to this topic only because we have so many calls
right.
and tweets, Wells.
Right.
And let me just get a reaction to all of you to a few comments coming into us on Twitter. Here's one from Josh. It's critical your listeners know that despite a recent spate of violence, violent crime in Jacksonville has actually been on a downward trend for years, both during the Alvin Brown and Lenny Curry administrations. And he tweets out a graph showing that rates of robbery, rape, and assault are down. And, of course, the murder rate is the big problem in Jacksonville. But even though we're very concerned about it, overall, the rates haven't spiked as much as people might realize when you look at the numbers. Here's another tweet. Is the answer to violent crime to give churches more funding? What will the Jacksonville city government do? We need all hands on deck, especially the agencies responsible for protecting citizens. And here's one more for all of you. These panelists are sounding tone deaf right now. It sounds like a money grab. This is bad PR. What's your reaction to that last one?
Well, quite frankly speaking, despite the fact that the Northside Coalition is a 501(c) nonprofit, we don't get any money. We haven't applied for anybody's grant. The bottom line is we're committed to change. It's not about a money grab. It's about people who have a care and concern about the people of this community. We'll let that one go as a shot across the bow. The bottom line is we care about this city. We love this city, and we want to see it change for the better.
And, you know, when you look at the root causes of which neighborhoods, for years, as you pointed out a minute ago, Wells, whether it's poor drainage after a hurricane, poor infrastructure, lack of social support, you can go all the way back to when the city consolidated 50 years ago.
Exactly.
And neighborhoods north and west of the urban core were promised certain things
right.
in terms of infrastructure, community and neighborhood development. Those promises were never followed through on.
Exactly.
Which is a big part of why we are here where we are today.
So much of what we're going through revolves around economics, economic degradation. Check out 32209, where 47% of the people are living in poverty.
Bonnie in Jacksonville Beach. Go ahead, Bonnie. You're on the air.
Hello, Melissa.
Hey, good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
First of all, I'd like to asked the caller that said crime rate was going down to go look at the Florida Department of Law Enforcement stats. As reported by JSO to FDLE, crime increased 2016 to 2017. This is violent crime offenses, 3.3%. And there's a 4.4% decrease in arrest of those that commit violent crimes. And that's according to JSO, not according to me. What I'd also like to say is, I think the mayor is at fault here. I think that we lack an executive vision that would pull the community together. I think as a leader, he is responsible for building the city, including the infrastructure and the communities. He's responsible for working with JSO and the city council to create a vision, create a plan, and execute it. City council and JSO and the mayor seem to be the tone-deaf individuals. And last night's performance of city council was extremely disheartening. I myself have spoken before city council twice and asked them to close the gun show loophole in Jacksonville. A group of organizations sent a letter to city council asking them to close the gun show loophole in Jacksonville and asked for a response, and they've never responded. Last night, I directly asked President Bowman if the city council had discussed this or if they would discuss it. He did not respond to my question. He responded saying, you know, this is your 3 minutes. It's up to you how you use it. And I said, sir, I believe the rules are to direct your questions to the presiding president, and that's you. And he flat out said, I'm not going to answer that question. So there's no connectedness, there's no collaboration, and there's no outlet for the community to have a voice. So I think that there is a complete lack of leadership vision in the city when it comes to the people. And definitely, I just have to say one other thing, and then I yield it back to you, Melissa. I was extremely hurt and disheartened of that picture of Mayor Curry standing by someone's bedside smiling while parents had children in the morgue. It's tone deafness. It's out of touch with people. It's not representative of what a leader should be doing in this community.
Okay. And Bonnie, thank you. I haven't seen that photo. I appreciate your thoughts. And you know what? We will, of course, extend an invitation to the new council president, Aaron Bowman, to appear on this program.
Who doesn't listen to the people.
And talk about all of this. Okay. Your reaction to Bonnie's comments. Pastor.
My mind going back to the comment that was mentioned about the panel is here grabbing for money. It seems to be that they're not listening to at all to what's going on and what's being said here. It's a difference when you're doing everything you can with what you have. And the meeting on yesterday morning from Reginald Gaffney was for us to come, for the ones who are already doing the work, the boots on the ground to come to be heard, and for them to give us more money or see what they can do about helping further do to reach more people. And so it's not about begging. Somebody even mentioned in the meeting yesterday, I'm tired of people begging for money. It's not about begging when there's a right to this money. First and foremost, I believe that we have to work together. I call it the five P's: pastors, principals, parents, police officers, and politicians. If we want to affect any change, all of us have to come together and humble ourselves. It's not about our own thing. It's about everybody. Like we mentioned earlier, the city hall doesn't belong to the city councilman. It belongs to the people.
That's right.
This is
right.
Our stuff.
Right.
And so when you're trying to say, well, we don't deserve our part, but you want us to do above and beyond, because every time something happens, they come to our church for help. They come to our church for jobs. They come to our church to assist. And I have to turn people away because we are not being funded by anything else, but by the offerings that are coming through. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to have some assistance available to assist with the community efforts, because we are policing our own neighborhood.
That's right.
And so we should have some type of assistance to help us further do our job in a good manner.
And let's be clear, too, that we're not asking anyone to give us anything.
That's right.
We're asking that the door be open so we can get it ourselves.
That's right.
Lots of calls as we talk about a slew of homicides in Jacksonville. Off and on, we've been the state's murder capital for the better part of two decades. It's simply unacceptable. And once again, we're in this place of crisis where the city, faith leaders, and activists are trying to find a way forward. And certainly the tension and frustration is as high as I've seen it in many years. Let's take a few more calls. William in Jack's Beach. William, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having my call, Melissa. I would just like to say that, especially to the pastors, as a former pastor myself, number one, the issue is a lot deeper than who's getting the money. If we look at the emphasis on the people we idolize, sports figures, actors, you know, et cetera, we're not teaching our children the real value of life and working together. And I appreciate what the pastors are saying and what they're doing, but talking about the money and direction of funds, I mean, how many more new church buildings do we need? You know, to quote a scripture, no greater love than any man has this, but he would lay down a life for a friend, his life. Maybe that doesn't mean literally catching a bullet for someone, but putting others' needs ahead of yourself. And finally, I'd like to say we need to teach people to think for themselves and wake up. Republicans, Democrats, their gig is to make us think we have a choice, and the other side is the evil person, and they have all the answers. There is no choice. The only thing politicians really are afraid of is losing their cushy jobs. And thank you for allowing me to speak, and I'll take the answers off air.
All right. Thanks, William. Let's close with you, Wells Todd. You know, the thing about this that is so incredibly depressing and frustrating, as you pointed out at the beginning of this hour, is that there was a really comprehensive, sincere citywide attempt years ago to address this problem. And it was exhaustively studied, researched. There were committees out the wazoo. There was a real commitment to prevention and intervention in the city of Jacksonville. And then it was simply cast aside after the recession and because of politics, whatever. Now here we are again, trying to find a piecemeal way to go about this. It's pretty disheartening. And so
it is.
I'd like to we're almost out of time. Your final thoughts about what the city and the activists can do to try to work together, if that's possible, to, you know, stop the bloodshed in this city?
We need to look at what is actually causing this. When you deny a community access to jobs, decent education, decent housing, and you leave a community out of the opportunities of wealth, you create poverty, you create food deserts. When jobs are minimum wage jobs, you end up with crime. Locally, we want to give the sheriff $30 million. Police have no accountability. We need a police accountability council. What we are saying here is we need to continue to build a movement in Jacksonville to fight for the rights of the people of this city. And I'm not just talking about African Americans. I'm talking about poor whites. I'm talking about brown folks. I'm talking about Native Americans. Mm. What we have been going through the past 50 years, okay, has been an attack on the working class in this country and an attack on poor folks. And we've had enough of it, okay? We need to send a message to the mayor's office, to the governor's office, and to the White House that we are building a movement here in Jacksonville.
Thank you both. Thank you, all three of you.
Thank
Wells
you
Todd,
very much.
Ben Frazier,
much.
Pastor
Thank
Atlas
you.
Rankin.
On the show.
We'll be right back. Welcome back. Well, we've heard a lot about the gig economy. So many Americans have a side hustle these days just to survive. Most of us are so worried about our job security, and for good reason. The root causes of the instability of the workforce, though, well, they might surprise you. Author Lewis Hyman explores the unmaking of the American workforce in his new book, Temp: How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. Take a listen. Lewis, you know, I have to tell you that I entered the American workforce as a temp. I was a Kelly girl during summers between college years and then for a little while after I graduated from college. Doing data entry. I was an office temp. And so I was really intrigued to read this book because when I was temping for Kelly Services, and back then they called us Kelly Girls. I don't know if they still do that. The temp was really an outlier in the office. You know, there weren't a lot of us, and you know, we would come and go quickly and move around from company to company when somebody was on vacation or somebody was sick. But I think what's so important about your book is how the temp worker, the gig economy worker, has become so ubiquitous. And I believe you actually were an office temp when you started. Is that what first interested you in this subject?
Yeah, my very first job when I was 15, my mother said, "You got to get a job." And I lived in Baltimore, and it was really hot in the summer, sort of, you know, like the South. And so I went to AccuStaff, and I worked as a data entry operator for that summer, and I got a taste of it. And many years later, I was working as a management consultant. And my very first day of arriving at my very first engagement, I realized, oh, wow, after all that education, I'm just a temp again, but a much better paid temp. But it started me down this path of thinking, Well, how has work changed? Why do I feel the same as a consultant, even though I'm wearing a suit, as I did when I was a temp? And it started me to think about how had work changed and why were the lives of people like me so different from the lives of how we imagined work would be when we were growing up.
And in this book, Temp, you really get into the history of how, I guess, corporate America's bond with its employees has changed over the years. And do you track this back to the post-war period, the period after World War II? Is that where this shift sort of began in the workplace?
Yeah, it really breaks around 1969, 1970. Yeah, when I wrote the book, I thought a lot about how today people sort of blame Uber and smartphones for workplace insecurity. And they do it, and it makes it seem like it's about technology, when really it's about business decisions. It's about how we think the workplace and our corporations should be organized. And so in the book, I trace how temp work emerged after World War II. And by temp, I don't mean just, you know, people who, like yourself, were Kelly girls, but people who also are consultants or migrant laborers, people who have a loose attachment to their employer. And so I show how this emerged during this moment of security, this moment of when we felt like everything was going right, that it was inevitable, the progress, wages were rising, stability had been achieved after depression and war. And yet it's in this moment we begin to see people like the founder of Manpower, Elmer Winter, beginning to push another vision, a vision where economic security is not actually doable. It's a business problem to be solved rather than, you know, an achievement to be celebrated. And right around 1970, there's a succession of crises surrounding the American corporation that I write about. And another vision is sold. And finally, this vision that Elmer Winter has been trying to sell for many years becomes widespread. And it's sold by management consultants and by business gurus as the right way to run a company. And then that's the world we really live in now. And it's not as much about technology as it is about, you know, how we think our corporation should be run.
Well, how the people running them think they should be run, maybe
yes,
not the workers.
Exactly. That's a good point.
You know, I think that so much of the anger that is floating around the country, I think your book gets at a piece of it, which is that people feel that the old social compact maybe is breaking down and that you can no longer find, for many Americans, a good paying job with benefits, and that benefits piece is so important because traditionally companies have offered benefits. And so if you're a temp, you're not going to have access to that. I think there's a lot of anger about that among the workforce out there. This feeling that, you know, that old security, that old relationship with the employer is gone.
Absolutely. I think that is the rage you see on both the left and the right, right? This is liberals and conservatives alike are furious that people work hard and they don't get paid for it. They don't have that kind of security. So one of the shocking statistics I've run across in the last few years has been how we talk a lot about income inequality, and I think a lot of people know about the 1% and the 99% now. Well, people know much less about the volatility of income, that for average Americans, the average household, not poor people, not rich people, just average Americans, a little over half of those people have month-to-month fluctuations in income of about 30%. And this means that you can't plan for your mortgage, you can't plan for your car payment. And this kind of volatility really just is just, humans aren't good at dealing with it. And we want a level of security. So even as people embrace this idea of flexibility and working when you want to work and, you know, trying to combine multiple gigs and freelancing, it's also terrifying trying to figure out how they're going to make ends meet. And, you know, that older world of work, that 9-to-5 office, that late shift at the factory, that's going away. In the last 10 years, 94% of net new jobs, that is new jobs created over jobs destroyed, according to a Princeton economist, have been in these alternative work arrangements, which is a fancy way of saying temp jobs. And it's something that we need to grapple with, the reality of that, rather than just be nostalgic for the past.
And how do we do that? And in particular, how do we as a society create the kind of safety net so that, say, if you're working a series of jobs, you can still have affordable health insurance and other types of benefits? Because we're not there yet as a society.
We're not. We're still. We still think that those kinds of benefits and, you know, the health care, the sort of paternity leave, the maternity leave, all the other things are tied to a job. And now, especially for younger folks, about half of people under 34 are working in this freelance economy, and they are not part of that. They don't have access to that. So we need to figure out a way to move forward and make sure that the independent workforce has some measure of security in their lives. And it's important whether you're a conservative or a liberal. I think this is an important point to drive home, that in the book I write about a conservative plan how to do this, where it would be an extension of the 401k. So the same way that you move from employer to employer now, you could move from gig to gig, just moving everyone to paying some small amount into your benefits or health care. Similarly, there's a liberal plan in the book as well that's more about sort of expanding Medicare for everybody, single payer, or having some kind of version of the basic income. But I think no matter what your politics are, you need to grapple with this change in work. And it's not going to be enough to just try to roll back the clock and go back to this older form of work. This is not how things are growing.
Right. And you do see, despite a lot of the bleakness surrounding this, some silver linings to the new workplace. What are those?
Well, I think it's important to realize that, you know, we traded our autonomy for security in the post-war. So I like to think that there's an older American dream about self-determination and autonomy, and we lost that in the 20th century. We took our paychecks at our desks or in our factories, and it was, you know, it was good to get that, to have that certainty. But it was also monotony and dreariness. And if you talk to people who work in offices for 30 years doing this, filling out the same form or turning a wrench in a factory for 30 years, it's soul-crushing work, and it's not human work. And I think that there is an opportunity here to reclaim that, kind of autonomy and variety in our work lives that we treasure as Americans. But at the same time, we need to make sure that it doesn't get rid of security. And there's ways to do it. There's not just one, you know, magic bullet for this, but there are lots of ideas put out in the book sort of talking about how to do this. And for me, that's the optimist in me. I'm very excited about this.
Yeah. And I hope CEOs in particular and shareholders pick up your book, because there are some important ideas in this book. It is Temp: How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. Author Lewis Hyman, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And in a moment, a farewell to one of the First Coast's most talented and creative people. That's after this.
I'm Marco Werman. On the world, we get an outside perspective.
I was born in Yemen.
So many people in Sweden.
Most people in South Africa.
Because getting outside yourself can be a good thing.
Once you move to a different country, you zoom out and you're able to see where is the other person coming from.
It is the world. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
The Civil War meant a lot of young Syrians had to put college or starting their careers on hold.
I think I found the thing that most people look for. I think I found why I'm here. I would give up anything for stand-up.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Syrians starting over in Turkey. That's next time on Marketplace. Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
A year after Hurricane Harvey, one company is facing criminal charges over a fire the storm caused at its facility. But not everyone agrees employees should face imprisonment.
Trying to find scapegoats and calling individuals felons? Are you kidding me? This is outrageous.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Who's to blame in the era of climate change? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Should we call timeout on the statute of limitations? The law dates back centuries, intended to protect the rights of defendants, but the rules vary. Some say it's based on an archaic understanding of sexual assault and the statutes of limitations need to go. Do we change the law or change how we investigate crimes? Next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it is your chance to meet one of the most talented and creative people in town. Sadly, it's your last chance because she's moving to Ireland. Yeah, I think next week.
This week. Saturday.
Nadia Ramatar and her co-author Marion Robinson, who's also quite talented. Typo in the script, are here now with more about a big book signing event tonight in St. Johns County. It's for 52 Ways to Feed My Mojo, and they join us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks, Melissa, for having us.
And Nadia, I love the book. I love everything you've done in this community, and I'm very sad to say that after many years on the First Coast doing amazing work, you're leaving, moving to Ireland.
Well, it's where I was born, so it's a homecoming of sorts. But the beauty of the digital realm is that I will still very much have a presence here, I hope. And I have family here and we'll be back and forth. My son's father is here, so we'll be doing some back and forth things. So I'm not entirely gone.
And so one thing you're leaving behind as a parting gift to the community is this incredible and vibrant new piece of work, a new book. Tell us about it.
Well, as you know, Melissa, you were gracious enough to have me last year. I did 52 Ways to Free My Mojo. And this year I partnered with Marion Thompson, an incredible health coach, and we did 52 Ways to Feed My Mojo, which is really about feeding your body and soul and mind to be creative.
So one new way a week, it sounds like. Tell me about what's in here, Marion.
Well, what we've done is chose 52 ways that we would be able to get ourselves feeling better. And we talk about how to shop, where to shop, where to spend your money, being grateful, cooking with each other.
Little things. You know, in a way, this reminds me of a book I loved some years ago called Simple Abundance.
Yes.
And that is the kind of book that you can pick up and open at any page and read something so inspiring.
Exactly.
And this is similar. Each page is a new nugget of inspiration. Is that the idea?
It really is. Melissa, as you know, I have a PhD in communications and I had created this book format where it was like writing. And I'm like, this is not inspiring. But what we found is that just preparing the images with the idea, and then what we have with each way is a suggestion that Marion and I came up with where people can actually try this. And so, like you said, they can just I Ching it and open it on any page, or they could do it systematically. And we're really excited. And we kind of get into more than just like physical food in terms of where's your food coming from, the politics of food, you know, chemicals, things that are good for you, things that are bad for you. So we kind of took a broad perspective on it. And you know, this is one of my favorite ones, avoid food porn. You know, there's so much in advertising that's like, eat me, you know, and we have to be careful about that.
And so this is an approach toward health, but all aspects of our health.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. It's what we're thinking about, who we're hanging out with, what our thoughts are. Are we stressed? I mean, food's very important, but the rest of our lives and how we look at food, how we treat it, is it just a treat or are we feeding ourselves so that we can live and stay healthy? It's great health insurance.
And, you know, when I look at the word mojo, I think of two people, Austin Powers,
yes,
and Shahid Khan. And now you guys.
We're in good company.
Austin Powers lost his mojo. Yes. It was very sad.
Yes.
Shahid Khan famously said, a homeless man in Detroit has more mojo than millionaires in Jacksonville, Florida. But he didn't know you, Nadia, so he was not quite right.
And I would love to know him, so that absolutely. And of course, you know, my father is Indian and my mother is Irish. And so I have that kind of classic immigrant story myself, you know, coming here as a teenager and that kind of thing. But, you know, the whole thing about mojo really is it's about creative energy. And the thing about that is that once you have that mojo going, it's magical because literally things just line up for you. Things that you're like, wow, that's a miracle. I can't believe this is happening. Well, that's what it's about.
You can pick up some of this mojo tonight at Nadia and Marian's book signing event. This is at 6:30 tonight. At 1515 County Road 210, correct?
Yes. And we have it on Facebook. If people want to go to Nadia Ramatar or Marian Thompson on Facebook, we have it on there. We'd be thrilled to see them. And then we also have it at oldcitybooks.com. People can order it. And we really appreciate that. It was so nice to work with a local publisher for a second time. And Cheyenne and Cynthia and all the people there that made it possible.
Well, kudos to you both, Nadia Ramatar and Marian Thompson. It's 52 Ways to Feed My Mojo. Come on out tonight and see them. And safe travels,
thank
my friend.
Thank you, my dear.
To the Emerald Isle.
Yes, hope to see you there.
Oh, I hope to see me there. I need to get there. One day I will. Thanks, ladies. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. Our theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. Next on 1A, Puerto Rico, present day, a closer look. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening to 89.9, and make sure to catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 p.m. We'll be back tomorrow morning, meantime, for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.